Welcome to the Development Policy Centre. In this podcast, you will hear a lecture from Professor Richard Bedford of the University of Waikato and President of the Royal Society of New Zealand. Professor Bedford's lecture is titled Towards an Integrated Labour Migration Strategy in Our Pacific Neighbourhood. You'll also hear from Professor Brian O'Peskin of the Macquarie Law School, Macquarie University, who was the discussant for the lecture, and Professor O'Peskin's remarks are followed by a general Q&A session. At the start of the podcast, you'll hear welcoming remarks from Professor Peter MacDonald of the Crawford School, and chairing the session is Professor John Connell of Sydney University. Enjoy the podcast.
I'm Peter MacDonald from the Crawford School of Public Policy, and I'm here to represent the Crawford School and welcome you all to the Crawford School. We must acknowledge that this evening we are meeting on the traditional lands of the Ngunnawal people. And my role tonight is to introduce the person who is going to introduce the person who is going to be the speaker. So a bit of a succession there. And so I'm introducing Professor John Connell, who earlier today described himself as middle-aged.
Middle-aged,
I think he said, yeah. I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration, as I remember well many decades ago when there was a strong functioning Department of Human Geography in this university, and John was employed there, and the Department of Demography, where I was, and the Department of Human Geography would engage in high-powered sporting events, and I remember John on the other side, in the cricket or the soccer. As I recall, they used to win the soccer, but we used to win the cricket. So anyway, that's of no consequence whatsoever.
Put John's age in his place.
And for the moment, for right now, Professor John Connell is a distinguished scholar of the Pacific. And has been for ever since those days the 1970s, and a professor of geography at the University of Sydney.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you, Peter. It is my very great pleasure to introduce Richard Bedford. However, as Brian introduced him this morning already, and was particularly engaging in his discussion of his musical contributions in trance music, he really doesn't need much more introduction. And I can't really compete with that. So enough about Richard, I'm going to talk about me. I came to Australia 42 years and 3 months ago to work on some things to do with migration. I was en route to Bougainville in Papua New Guinea. When I got to Bougainville, I inherited Richard's red Toyota van. It was almost new at the time. I had it for 6 months, and I sold it for $50. That was my driving skills were a bit limited in those days. I also inherited some of Richard's cutlery and his cups and saucers as well, which are extremely useful. And then I spent the rest of my 40 years following Richard around the Pacific. He got to the New Hebrides, as it was then, before I did. He got to Fiji, he got to Kiribati, he got to Tuvalu. Sometimes I was only a year behind him, sometimes mere months. In Niue, I was actually only 2 weeks behind him. But I never actually really caught up with him. Because he is the expert on migration in the Pacific, and a very migratory one at that. So it's not just a pleasure, but it's an honour to introduce Richard. He is Emeritus Professor at the University of Waikato and at the Auckland University of Technology. His MA thesis, which he talked about this morning, was on resettlement in Kiribati. His PhD was on then the New Hebrides, now Vanuatu. During a very distinguished career at the University of Canterbury and the University of Waikato, he has received the Distinguished New Zealand Geographer Medal for services to geography. He's been elected to life membership of the New Zealand Geographical Society and to the Population Association of New Zealand. In 2008, he was made a Companion of the Queen's Service Order, QSO, in recognition of his services to geography. No mean honour indeed. 2 years later, in 2010, he was awarded the Royal Society of New Zealand's Dame Joan Metke Medal for the Social Sciences in recognition of his research in the Pacific and his leadership in developing social sciences in the region. Since then, he's completed projects on migration policy for the ILO in the region, the Nansen Initiative, and so on. He basically never really stops. I've never really been able to catch up with him. Finally, he is now president of the Royal Society of New Zealand, which is an extraordinary honour and recognition for a very distinguished service over the years. So not only is he the most distinguished geographer in New Zealand, he's an outstanding luminary of social sciences in New Zealand. We're extremely privileged to have him here today. It's all yours, Richard. Go for it.
Well, those were very generous words from John Connell, who, as you would turn that on, you would have gathered, we had known each other for a while, and really, I'm following in Connell's footsteps as a writer on the Pacific. There is no person that I'm aware of who has written so extensively and published in so many different sources the work on the Pacific migration. So I think with the combination of people that we've brought together for this workshop, as I think Richard said at the beginning, there are a number of people that have spent a lot of time working on migration and thinking about migration. What I want to do in this presentation is not spend too much time with things on the PowerPoint. I've got a short set of comments I would like to make under a heading towards a Pacific Labour strategy. And I want to start just with a quick reflection on the question that Matthew Dornan posed right at the end of his comments on the workshop. And it's a really important question. Why should we have a focus on the Pacific? Why is there anything special about this region that we should be giving any real thought in migration policy anyway to this group of countries? And as a geographer, I always like to put up the map that shows where we are. And it's pretty obvious when you put up the map of Australia, particularly featuring a city on the east coast, and even more obvious when you put it up with New Zealand at the centre of the map, the world that surrounds you is predominantly Pacific. I mean, in terms of real distances and everything, this is our world. And one of the things about our worlds is they're our neighbours. And as Europe is discovering at the moment, as it deals with the worst migration crises it's ever had, exceeding those, I think, in the Second World War, it really is grappling with monumental migration issues. It's dealing essentially with migration in its neighbourhood. Migration that's making its way into its neighbourhood, the North African fringe, the Middle East, into Eastern Europe. And it is really struggling. Now, I'm not forecasting that we're going to have a situation like that in this region. But what I am suggesting, and have suggested at other times, and which New Zealand and Australia discovered themselves during the Second World War, we really do risk missing some key things if we are not keeping an eye on what's happening around here. After all, it was an invasion from off the map, in this case, that had Australia probably more nervous than anything else at any other time in its European history, in terms of what was some sort of invasion, not just down here, but through all through here. So the region, in many ways, is part of us. But also with reference to Matthew's question, New Zealand and Australia have very different answers to this question. And I think we need to acknowledge that and acknowledge a point that our colleague from DFAT said. And I think it was a really important corrective to some of the discussion. New Zealand and Australia are very, very different in all sorts of ways, not least of which, of course, is the one that she referred to, scale. you know, our population will be half of Papua New Guinea's population in a couple of years. We had the same population in 1950. We had 2 million each. But Papua New Guinea will be double the population of New Zealand in not too far away, when it gets to 9 million. And the other thing is, New Zealand's first people are people from over here. And because we have a different constitutional arrangement and different history about how we have engaged with that population through a treaty, a formal treaty, and then later through continual ratification or reification of that treaty through settlements and so on, we can never, ever escape our Polynesian heritage. We are part of Polynesia, and that can never, ever be forgotten in New Zealand. And it's people that Alisi's forebears and others who came later after the Second World War and have given us one of our biggest subgroups in the population, the Pacific people. We have a very different relationship with the Pacific from Australia historically, in some senses, not entirely. We both were colonisers. We had that sort of thing in common. We both exploited Kiribati and Tuvalu and Nauru endlessly for phosphate. We both did extremely well out of that in terms of our agricultural industries. So there are some common points in our relationship with the Pacific, but there are also some big differences. So when I come to talk about a sort of Pacific strategy, please don't interpret these comments as trying to imply that New Zealand is trying to tell Australia what would be a good strategy. I'm not going to do that at all. I think New Zealand has got one or two policy initiatives that might be worth looking at. And interestingly, the Australian government three times has funded research on the Pacific Access category. Going right back into the 1980s. They've looked at this the category didn't exist in the 1980s, into the quota system, into the way that New Zealand's migration policies worked. And, Reg Appleyard had a look at it, Chuck Stiles had a look at it, Graham Hugo's had a look at it, Richards had a very good look at it. There's been a lot of attention focused on that particular scheme, but Australia has never bought into it. There's not been a scheme that it's attracted Australia. In the course of what I say, I actually want to commend Australia on some very, very significant shifts in policy. I don't think academics ever give enough credit to the public service or even to the politicians for the extent to which they do make shifts in policy. And that is actually really important, and I will touch on that. But first, I just want to come back to something that's been referred to. Late in August this year, just a couple of months away, New Zealand will host a special Pacific Labour Mobility annual meeting. It's got a dreadful acronym that no one can pronounce, PLMAM. If you can pronounce that well, PLMAM, that's impossible, so they're going to change the acronym. This is a sign of good faith with progressing the Labour Mobility Arrangement, which is attached to but separate from the as-yet-unsigned PACER Plus agreement. Basically, New Zealand is, PACER Plus, as we know, has been under negotiation and in the making for several years. And it represents perhaps the latest concerted effort across the Pacific Forum countries to get a mutually acceptable multi-party agreement that addresses some dimensions of labour mobility. The PACER Plus agreement itself, the formal agreement, includes a chapter on mobility of natural persons. I've always wondered what unnatural persons were, but it's always called mobility of natural persons, addressing the provision of services. Essentially, it relates to skilled migration in a range of services that are covered in most free trade agreements that are developed under the WTO's rules. This chapter is part of the legally binding document. I won't discuss it further, aside from noting that it will provide, as was noted earlier today, a framework within which some skilled migration of Pacific people might be able to occur to Australia and New Zealand, and equally some skilled migration into Pacific countries might well be able to occur through those provisions. The bit that sits outside the formal agreement is the bit that's taken so long to try and nail down. And this is the labour mobility arrangement. It's not legally binding, but it is an integral part of the package that representatives of the Ministries of Foreign Affairs and Labour across the region, including Australia and New Zealand, have been negotiating over for some time. It is this agreement that the Pacific Islanders insist on having if they're going to sign the PACER Plus agreement. Because the PACER Plus agreement to the many Pacific countries isn't going to offer a huge amount in their eyes to them over and above what they're already getting out of some of their other agreements. So they're leveraging the trade negotiations to get a better labour mobility deal. And that's a common strategy with these free trade agreements, it seems. Now, I don't know the details of this arrangement. Carmen probably knows far more about this than me because she was working with the OCTA at the office in the Pacific, which has been at the forefront of the negotiations. It's an office funded in part by Australia and New Zealand to help the Pacific countries get a collective negotiating position around labour mobility. What I am aware of is that states have agreed that a part of this agreement is there will be an annual meeting addressing labour mobility issues involving Pacific countries and Australia and New Zealand. And the first of these is to be held in New Zealand, and this meeting in August, which will actually be before the treaty, before the agreement is signed, will be the first of these meetings under the labour mobility arrangement. And what will happen in August, and I clarified this on Monday when I spoke with the people from Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade and the labour group, is that two new pilot temporary work schemes, which had been referred to briefly in the conference already for Pacific workers, that coming to New Zealand will be underway, and they're going to use that pilot. They'll start this month. They're going to use the August conference to allow delegates from the Pacific to meet with prospective employers and to try and negotiate arrangements for employment of Pacific workers in the construction industry, in the rebuilding of Canterbury, and in New Zealand's commercial fishing industry, particularly the industry focusing on our own extensive economic zone. So the representatives that come from the country will be given direct access to the employers who are interested in trying to see if they can get appropriately qualified and skilled workers from the Pacific. Now, it's been this comes back to a question that came up again a couple of times during the meeting. Why would the, if you're an employer, why would you want somebody from the Pacific necessarily? If you can get really good workers from the Philippines or from England or from Ireland, which is where most of our construction workers come from, why would you take them from the Pacific? Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade in New Zealand and the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment have emphasised that it is a New Zealand priority to try and find opportunities for skilled, semi-skilled and unskilled work for Pacific labour as part of our engagement with our neighbourhood. So it's very much a politically driven initiative. It's not something the employers were asking for. They weren't saying, well, we want Pacific workers. Can you help us get them? This is something which fits much more with, I think it was Nick or somebody made a reference to the political imperative of engagement. So it's not a neoliberal, we just want to get workers in to help the employers, because the employers actually haven't really shown any interest at all. But they're now interested because it's been pushed. The schemes will not be big. purely and simply because they're employer-led, and if there's not a big demand from the employers for the labour, there won't be growth of a large number. And somebody today made a very important point that we have to be really careful when we explore openings for labour, that we don't send unwittingly all sorts of signals about massive demand. I mean, one of the big differences to me between the New Zealand REC scheme and the Australian REC scheme, in, or seasonal work program rather, in terms of the uptake, is purely and simply that by the time New Zealand got underway with its seasonal work scheme in April 2007, there were over 100 employers who wanted labour. That's why the first line on the graph was up to the cap. It reached the cap in 1 year, 5,000 workers. And that's because the employers had had 2 to 3 years to think about it, work out their reason for wanting it, develop within the industry a strong sense that this was a win for them, not a cost in the sense that it seems to have been assessed in the Australian. It was a cost to them. They had to pay half the airfare. They had to get accommodation sorted out. They had pastoral care. But they saw a return on productivity as a far greater gain than the cost they were going to pay for the labour. That's not a bad starting point for one of these schemes. For these little schemes that are coming up in the fishing industry, in the construction industry, that doesn't exist at the moment. There's not that sense amongst the employers that this is going to be a really big win for them. So the other thing I need to just clarify about those schemes is that they're not mini REC schemes. And this is where they're going to be, I think, quite problematic in the Pacific. There's no employer subsidy on airfares. There's no requirement for employers to pay half an airfare. There is a requirement that they pay reasonable wages and they'll be monitored on that. And there is a requirement that they attend to pastoral care. And the Ministry of Business Innovation and Employment has already lined up major pastoral care support networks for Pacific workers when they come in. But imagine a worker from Kiribati, a seafarer from Kiribati. They're targeting Kiribati for the seafarers. They're going to have to front up with half the equivalent airfare to London to get to Auckland. That's what it costs to get from Tarawa to Auckland. To get from Samoa to Auckland, $300. To get from Tarawa to Auckland, $1,300, $1,400. No Kiribati is going to find that easy to find, either in their family network or immediately. These are the challenges that will face some of these new initiatives. Now, I've started with this comment about this Labour Mobility Agreement and this annual migration meeting, because it is an attempt to address labour market issues at a regional level. And notwithstanding many criticisms of PACER Plus, I mean, there's some strong opposition to PACER Plus in Pacific countries, in New Zealand, and I suspect in Australia, around these free trade agreements, what they mean, who they privilege, how they work. Notwithstanding all of that, this is an attempt, a negotiated attempt, to work at a regional level on a labour migration strategy. And I think we've got to take that as a very positive step if we're looking at moving into the future, how we deal with labour migration at a regional level. It's not the only regional initiative. Some of you in the room were at a meeting in Vanuatu very recently, what the Pacific Islands Labour Sending Countries Forum, or the PALES, I've never quite worked out what the acronym, how it works, the PALES meeting. This is one that is supported by the World Bank. It's the third. First was in Tonga, then there was one a few years ago in Samoa. This is the most recent one in Vanuatu. A very important attempt to get the countries in the Pacific to develop their own strategies for targeting external labour opportunities. And where the World Bank has been putting a lot of support and investment in here is to help them together to bulk up because the region's only got a very small population, to bulk up a strategy which is not just one country competing with another country in every labour market opportunity, but looking at labour market opportunities more strategically across the region, which are ones that some countries could respond to better than others. We don't all have to be in every single one of them. And the second thing is, how do we deal with the legislative things that support workers and that surround that? So this is another very important initiative which has been directed at improving the capacity of Pacific countries to actually respond to opportunity, to demand, like the Korean initiative, if it comes up. A third is, and I want to pay tribute to the work that Carmen's co-author, Sophia Kagan, has done with the International Labour Organization. The International Labour Organization and its Pacific office has worked extensively with a number of Pacific countries to develop national labour migration policies. The one, and Carmen spoke about one that she was involved in Kiribati. They've done these in other countries, and they're supporting other have been supporting other countries. In addition to that, they've been supporting countries to develop their statistics on labour and labour migration, which, as we've learned already in some of the presentations, are really problematic. I mean, a question of Stephen Close a minute ago was, what did that 4% mean in comparison to that 28%? And Stephen's answer was, well, it's actually quite tricky to answer that because they could be working off different bases. So they've been trying to get different Pacific statistics offices to have more consistent and coherent ways. And the third, the final initiative I would mention, really as an illustration of these regional ones, is actually one that was funded out of Geneva by the Norwegians, the Nansen Initiative, which has been looking at displacement of populations as a result of natural disaster. And built into that is a concern for the changing nature of natural disasters with climate change. The Nansen Initiative held a major regional meeting in the Pacific in the Cook Islands. And out of that meeting came a number of very important studies of the Pacific, which are trying to establish much more clearly what is the contemporary architecture, legislative architecture, the administrative structures and things that surround international migration in the Pacific. And Nick McLennan's point earlier today about somehow we've forgotten the Francophone region is critically important in this context, because the Francophone part of the Pacific is a big, important part of the Pacific as we're moving into this century, and it's going to have, particularly in French Polynesia, there are going to be some significant issues around climate change and so on. So what emerges from this analysis of the architecture is a whole host of sub-regional kind of hubs and clusters and networks that we need to understand more of, some of which have been developed within the region itself. So I think the not only is there interest in many of these regional initiatives, a lot of the comment has been, how can Australia and New Zealand open up their labour markets for us? But that's only been part of the discussion. There's also been a focus on what are the labour demands within the region? And again, coming back to some of Carmen's earlier work that she's done, migration of teachers, migration of medical personnel. John Connell's done a lot of work on this in the health sector. There's quite a significant movement within the region. There's quite a significant labour exchange in the region, which we don't tend to acknowledge. We tend to get a bit caught up with, they only want to come and see us. But in fact, Fiji has labour demands. Papua New Guinea will become a major centre for migration, as Carmen has also noted. And so we need to acknowledge that there are demands within the region, as well as this expectation that Australia and New Zealand might open up. Well, just to look briefly for a minute at Australia and New Zealand, as we've already heard, probably the most successful region-wide scheme that Australia and New Zealand are participating in are these seasonal work schemes. They are now regional-wide. Both Australia and New Zealand scheme is open, I think, to people from any of the Pacific Forum countries. New Zealand certainly is. It's being facilitated in some countries more than others, but it is open to workers from Micronesia, Polynesia or Melanesia. If they want to come, if they can have an employer who wants them. So far, there have been no employers who've wanted to bring workers from FSM, Palau or the Marshall Islands. And as somebody pointed out in their presentation, Richard, I think, very small numbers have come from Kiribati and Tuvalu because of cost. So participation in these work schemes is expensive for some Pacific people, and that is means that there won't be a huge rush of people, I think, from a number of countries into whatever kind of temporary work scheme Australia and New Zealand set up, despite the impression in Australia and New Zealand that they might be inundated with workers. They will never be inundated where schemes are employer-led, that's for sure. One of the key important things about these schemes that I think is under-emphasised, and I think it's been really important in New Zealand, I think it is important in Australia, is that these schemes, they're subject to a lot of criticism because temporary work schemes or seasonal work schemes have a very bad press internationally, generally. They're generally seen as exploitative or potential for exploitation. They don't. The workers don't have the same rights as the workers in the country they're coming to work in. There are all sorts of restrictions on how they can move around in the country. But the fact, these schemes have been very important, for, particularly in New Zealand, for rebuilding a confidence in the fact that you can have temporary work schemes with the Pacific without problems of compliance and overstaying. You need to remember that New Zealand had work schemes with Pacific Islanders from the 1960s. Every single one of them had a huge overstayer problem because they never had a good way of trying to monitor where these people were working or having these people return home. And it actually took quite a lot of persuading New Zealand's officials to engage in the seasonal work scheme. And as Richard hinted, the Pacific Access category finally wiped out all of the old existing temporary work schemes because of our need regularly to address the overstayer issue and to regularise people's place in New Zealand. So what this scheme has done in New Zealand, because of the way it's been managed and the way it's been monitored and the way it's been invested in by government, it's meant that they've regained quite a strong level of confidence that we can have these temporary schemes. And we can have them working reasonably well, and people will go home. And New Zealand does not have a lot of overstayers in its 9,000 seasonal workers. One group generally dominates, and they're a group that dominates in Australia. The Tongans are probably more adept at running or not going home than others. But I think in New Zealand there might be 7 overstayers from Tonga. I don't think there's ever been an overstayer from Kiribati or Tuvalu or the Solomons. So this has rebuilt confidence. And this is partly why New Zealand's prepared to go and have a look at a whole lot of other temporary schemes, because they now think they've got, with their relationships with the Pacific, building up their relationships with their governments, we've now got better ways of managing these flows. But I do have to acknowledge, these are not everybody's cup of tea, these schemes. There is strong criticism in New Zealand in certain quarters and in Australia from a rights-based perspective about the way these schemes manage the workers, and they don't have opportunities to take up other visas while they're in the country. Having said that, I'm doing work at the moment with Ngāi Vanuatu workers on their remitting behaviour and talking quite a lot with the workers, some of whom have come back 7 or 8 times to New Zealand. They wouldn't give these schemes away for anything. These schemes are incredibly important from their point of view. And I think we just need to be a little cautious sometimes when we embark on our criticism of aspects of schemes. If you haven't got work anywhere else, these schemes are actually really, really valuable. I also want to acknowledge something that Australia And actually, I think Stephen House has done some very good work on this. He's been tracking how Australia's policy has shifted over the last decade. Australia, far more than New Zealand, has actually moved to engage effectively with the Pacific in the last 10 years. I'm going to now just spend a second looking at a very interesting contribution to your development blog by Alessio Kingiano and Andrea Torre from the University of the South Pacific. This went up on your blog, I think, about a month ago or a few weeks ago. And it poses a really important question that we have to consider when we look at a labour mobility strategy. The question is temporary migration a substitute for more inclusive migration opportunities? In other words, have we swung away from migration to just let's have temporary schemes and flick people back home again? I would also note that Alessio and Andrea have just recently edited a special issue of the Journal of Pacific Studies on migration issues in the Pacific, which I think has got some very interesting papers in it, including one by Brian Opeskin, who's going to make a few comments after this on Australia's refugee policy in the Pacific. But to come back to their question, is temporary migration a substitute for more inclusive migration opportunities? So they review the New Zealand evidence, and they're right. The New Zealand evidence isn't all that fantastic in this regard. Not when you bear in mind the long history of association between New Zealand and countries in the Pacific around migration. If you look at the residence approvals in New Zealand, and we have good data on these, kept continuously, the number of approvals for residents, and this is all residents, skilled, business, family, the access, the quotas, which are residence quotas, humanitarian of other kinds, like getting approval if you're an overstayer. The actual number of residence visas that have been approved in New Zealand over those 3-5 year periods has been steadily going down. Now, it's not a huge drop, only 1,000 there, but this is quite a significant drop in recent years, in the last 5 year period. This is all countries. Note that they've also gone down. So it's not just the Pacific. And this is actually poses a bit of a challenge for New Zealanders, because they keep hearing in the media you've got record levels of migration at the moment, and the academics have to keep going back and telling the media, well, actually, we had more migrants 10 years ago than we've got now. We've got more temporary migrants, not immigrants. And the share, and this is what Andrea and Alessio were referring to, the actual share of the total that's Pacific has dropped. So that's the residence flows. What about the temporary flows? Well, the temporary flows have a bit of a hiatus, because this, of course, is the impact of the RSE in 2007. So the first 5 years of the RSE is caught up there. But there's been a 10,000 drop in temporary migrants from the Pacific. Not the RSE scheme, that's just one component. This is all temporary visas. RSE is about 9,000 each, well, 9,000 a year now. So it's about half, possibly half of those visas. The other half will be other temporary visas. And this, interestingly, also mirrors a small drop in the total number of temporary visas. A huge growth from the mid-2000s in temporary visas, partly linked with the reconstruction of Christchurch and some other major development plans. And again, they pointed to this. New Zealand share has dropped. Now, in New Zealand, if you talk in the public, they would think they've been going up. But in fact, when you look at the evidence, New Zealand hasn't been delivering a great deal more to the Pacific in the last 5 years. And when you put the temporary and the skilled and business, or the work residence visas, along with the temporary work visas, you can see, again, the drop, in which is to be expected because the other two had dropped overall from the Pacific. So in this sense, there's been a drop in the residence visa, a huge growth in the temporary visa, and New Zealand will have to watch that the question that they've posed, is temporary migration just simply displacing opportunities for permanent flows, doesn't become too entrenched. Another thing which is very interesting from the from all of this is that, of course, it's the long-term migration that gives the opportunities for Pacific migrants to have access to decent work, to actually achieve some upskilling in a significant way, to get some career growth, to get some significant professional and technical qualifications, which might be useful back home, but will definitely be useful if they're going to grow their futures and careers in these countries. So it's very important that we don't just keep a focus on temporary, because that is not going to give Pacific labour access to work that will allow career growth. The other thing that I think is quite interesting is that if you look at the last 2 5-year periods, or last 2 intercensal periods in New Zealand and Australia, there's been a very interesting shift in terms of where most of the growth in the Pacific population has been occurring. This is the Pacific-born population in Australia and in New Zealand at our last 3 censuses. And because ours was delayed, it's got out of sync with Australia. In the early 2000s, there was a lot more movement into New Zealand than into Australia. But in the last 5 years, Australia has had a much more significant growth in its Pacific-born population than New Zealand. And I actually agree with the colleague from the from DFAT that I think we will see by the 2020s Australia outstripping New Zealand in the seasonal schemes. I don't think there's any doubt that will happen eventually. It's happened much more slowly than the New Zealand employers thought. I also think it won't be all that long before Australia has a larger Pacific-born population than New Zealand. And you need to recall that that's what the situation was for the first 50 years of Australia's federation. You had a much bigger Pacific population than New Zealand did. Did I hit something?
No, it was at
6:15. Okay, well, I will finish because the only other 2 things I wanted to mention that were regional initiatives that I haven't touched on were the Pacific Immigration Directors Conference, which is a major initiative coordinated through an office in Fiji, where all of the immigration officials, the senior immigration officials of island countries, and I think Australia and New Zealand regularly engage in that, dealing with migration issues, including irregular migration and people smuggling. And I don't want us to downplay the significance of the forum discussion, regular forum discussion, about the impacts of climate change in the Pacific. Australia and New Zealand and Pacific countries aren't on the same page. Well, they weren't at the last forum meeting. I suspect at the next forum meeting they will be a little bit closer, particularly as Australia and New Zealand both signed up to that aspirational pledge in Paris to have global warming over the long period contained at less than 2 degrees, which I think is going to be virtually impossible. But they signed up to it, which means that there's going to be a lot of pressure on them to work around the emissions area. These are really important initiatives in the context of migration and labour migration. And I think the whole area of environmental change in the Pacific is one that needs far closer attention in the context of labour migration strategy. So where do we go from here? Well, actually, the short answer is we don't go far at all. And we don't go far, to come back to a point Nick McLellan made, because we need to understand the politics of this. We're in an election year in Australia. In fact, I think you're having an election in 2 weeks or something, or 2 months or whatever. I can't remember when it is. It's not far away.
It feels like 2 months.
I mean, ours isn't for over a year, but it's already started. The politicking, the preparing for it. And when I went and saw the Minister of Immigration on Monday this week to make sure that I had a real understanding of where he was coming from rather than this funny quote he gave in statement in the House, he just said, this is not the time to raise the question of significantly increasing migration to New Zealand from anywhere, because we have the highest levels of migration. This is the mantra. We have a housing crisis in Auckland. We have more people living on the street than we've ever had in New Zealand before. We've got all sorts of challenges, which half of which they're sheeting to migration, but actually don't have anything to do with migration. But that's the public imaginary. So he said, don't come with lots of suggestions that we have big schemes at the moment. But that said, we are looking far more carefully at how we can address a number of migration issues in the Pacific. So I think what academics often need to understand is the rhetoric that might occur at the political level isn't the only story in town. There is another story often underneath, but the timing and how that is comes to the surface is absolutely critical. I think the most productive way to move ahead is to build quietly on the very productive dialogue and work that's been done in recent years, to acknowledge that Australia has made big steps in the policy arena, not to constantly bash them on the head and say it's not enough. I've learned over the years that bashing either policymakers or politicians on the head achieves nothing. But occasionally, if you acknowledge that things are moving and there are ways you can move a little bit faster, you actually see things begin to move even further. I think a lot has been done to promote a more coherent Pacific regional strategy already, and I think PACER Plus discussions have helped that. Even if PACER Plus itself isn't going to be the answer to much, the negotiations have been incredible. Been wins in recent years. There's a greater awareness of the importance, I think, of the Pacific as a region in immigration policy in Australia and in New Zealand. That's particularly in Australia. I think there's been quite a lot of engagement at official levels over a range of Pacific issues, including migration. To use a very old phrase, which isn't popular in the Pacific anymore, probably, I think we're actually been making progress in what used to be called a Pacific way, which is about getting some consensus, getting some sense that people are now comfortable to move in a particular direction. And if we can get normalised, whatever that will mean in the future with Fiji, it's never going to be the same as it was. If we can get relationships, better relationships again with Fiji, we're moving in that direction, but we've got a long way to go, I believe. I think we will have some real hope of getting an integrated regional labour strategy worked out within the next 5 or 6 years. But we won't do it tomorrow. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Richard, for that inspiring Twilight saga. I should say that I'm just about to introduce Brian to be a discussant. And then after that, we're going to have about 10 minutes for discussion of Richard's paper. So let me introduce Professor Brian Piskin, who is Professor of Law at the Macquarie University. Perhaps more importantly, he spent several years at the University of the South Pacific as Professor of Law there as well. He's been very involved in migration policy. And he's such indeed a dedicated grassroots lawyer that I think he probably could be considered an honorary geographer. Brian, over to you.
That's the nicest honor I've ever received, actually.
Well, Richard, thank you very much for your address tonight with its call for a more coordinated approach to labour migration in the Pacific region. It's obviously a topic that's very close to your heart, and we're fortunate to have had the benefit of your lifetime of experience and reflection on the issue. I just wanted to offer a few brief comments, not on the detail, but really on first principles. And I want to start in my own comfort zone, which is related to the legal framework that underpins the international movement of persons. There's just 5 points that I want to make, and they're fairly broad brush. So the first one is about freedom to exit. Discussions about labour mobility typically focus on barriers to entry. But I want to say something about the other side of the process, and that is exit. Pacific Island countries have little capacity to regulate emigration, that is to say, the movement of persons from their territory. And that's because international human rights law confers on everyone the freedom to leave any country, including their own. So this means if a person chooses to leave, there's very little that can be done about it. A Fijian nurse is free to depart Fiji so long as she can find another country that will accept her. But not everyone who wants, can leave wants to leave. There are 4 million New Zealanders on the other side of the Tasman who could make Australia their home tomorrow if they chose to do that under the Tasman arrangements. But they don't. And similarly, as we heard earlier today, there are many residents in the US compact states in the Pacific who do not move to the United States, even though they have the freedom to do so. So my point here is that we shouldn't assume that the Pacific, with more open borders, would necessarily look substantially different from the Pacific that we see today. My second point relates to national sovereignty and the right to enter, and it's simply this. The right to exit has no counterpart with respect to entry. Freedom of movement is not a symmetrical right. With only a few limitations, states have a high degree of latitude in determining who enters their territory. And in doing so, they're entitled to form their own judgments about what best serves their national interests. Now, in much of the discussion of Pacific migration, including Richard's, economic interests take precedence. For example, the RSE scheme in New Zealand and the seasonal worker scheme in Australia are at root schemes about filling labour shortages in receiving countries to assist domestic economies. Or if I could borrow Bill Clinton's expression from his 1992 presidential campaign, it's the economy, stupid. But I think we need to acknowledge that neither individuals nor states exist in the economic sphere alone, and that migration fulfills a wide range of policy goals. Some of those goals are humanitarian, such as Australia's commitment last year to take 12,000 Syrian refugees above the usual quota. Some of the goals are social, as happens with family reunion migration, which aims to build stronger societies by promoting family unity. Some of the goals relate to regional peace and security. I was brought to mind a statement by President Nixon talking about foreign aid when he said, "The main purpose of American aid is not to help other nations, but to help ourselves." And the same could be said of migration programs. It seems fairly clear to me anyway that regional peace and security could be promoted for the benefit of Australia and New Zealand and other participants by providing an outlet for the large numbers of unemployed youth in Melanesia, the so-called arc of instability. And there may be some goals that are simply moral, like the responsibility that former colonial powers have towards countries that were formerly under their charge, especially where colonisation brought with it exploitation. And Nauru comes easily to mind there. So my general point here is that it's important not to let hard-headed economic rationalism drown out all the other policy dimensions of migration. The third point relates to discrimination in entry, which has popped up in a few guises today. So I mentioned before that states are generally free to pursue their own interests in formulating their migration policies. But this freedom is not absolute. International human rights law contains a lot of well-developed non-discrimination norms that make it unlawful for a state to discriminate on the basis of race, religion, nationality, and so on. And Donald Trump will have to contend with this when he attempts to make America great by banning Muslim immigrants. So for many years, Australia has operated a migration policy that was facially neutral as to country of origin. I say facially neutral because there are still some arguments that requirements such as English language requirements do in fact operate in a way that is discriminatory. But let's just leave those aside for the moment. That facially neutral policy is the penance that Australia paid for 75 years of the White Australia policy. But as Richard mentioned, the preference given to Pacific Island countries under the seasonal worker program were really the first major inroads into the non-discriminatory migration policy. Now, it is consistent with international law because discrimination is about adverse treatment. And here, Australia is providing additional benefits or additional channels for migration when all the other channels are still available. So the real question is not whether it's lawful, but whether it's good policy. Now, I have a feeling Richard would say it definitely is. And I tend to agree, but I do think it's a matter of balance. The danger is that it invites further special pleading. And so the rationale needs to be really clear and well articulated. The fourth point I want to make is in relation to refugees. So another limitation that states face on their ability to regulate who comes into their borders arises because of legal commitments in relation to refugees. So as everyone will know, under the Refugee Convention, a country cannot return a person to a territory where he or she may face persecution on one of the grounds listed in the convention. In fact, the Pacific does not generate many refugees. Using UNHCR data, in 2014, there were only 1,300 Pacific Islanders who sought refuge in countries outside the country of their nationality. And nor do many people seek refuge in the Pacific from other countries. So in that same year, there were about 10,000 people who sought refuge in Pacific Island countries, and almost all of those were West Papuans fleeing from Irian Jaya. But there is a refugee issue that does need to be resolved. So long as Australia seeks to foist its asylum seeker problem, in inverted commas, on Pacific Island countries such as Nauru and Papua New Guinea, there are likely to be unnecessary irritants in the negotiation of stable labour migration schemes in the region. And unfortunately, there's only a hair's breadth in the policy between the major political parties in Australia, so that doesn't look like that's an issue that's going to go away anytime soon. And my last point is simply this. I think implicit in Richard's talk tonight is the fact that states have a variety of conceptual tools in managing migration: unilateral, bilateral, regional, multilateral. So unilateralism occurs where a state sets its own domestic migration laws and just sees who comes. And New Zealand's Pacific Access category is a good example of a unilateral rule that gives preferential treatment to Pacific Island countries. Bilateralism is where arrangements arise from some express accommodation of interests between two states. And in fact, the Pacific is dotted with examples of bilateral arrangements that facilitate labour mobility. New Zealand's Samoan quota, which Richard mentioned, is based on a treaty. The Trans-Tasman travel arrangements, which I just mentioned before. The compacts of free association, between some Pacific Island countries and New Zealand and some Micronesian countries and the United States. And in fact, the RSE scheme and the seasonal worker scheme, it's just a bilateral arrangement on steroids, really. It's just a network of bilateral arrangements. Then we have regionalism, and here we could consider PICTA and PACER Plus and the labour mobility arrangements under the Melanesian Spearhead Group. And multilateralism, which is probably the most disappointing of all of them, in the sense that it really only finds expression in Mode 4 labour mobility under the General Agreement on Trade in Services. Natural persons, I think I can say, Richard, lawyers must be responsible for that. Natural persons versus juridical persons like corporations. So I think that's probably the reason. So I think one of the important points that Richard has made is that there has been a significant shift in recent years away from unilateralism towards bilateralism and regionalism in negotiating labour mobility in the Pacific. And I agree that there is clear utility in that. Migration is a social process and it affects more than the receiving state. But I think states will always want to maintain that mix of options from unilateralism through to multilateralism, and a state's right to regulate who enters its territory, I don't think is likely to be abandoned anytime soon.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian. We have, I think, 10 minutes or so for questions to either Brian or particularly to Richard.
I just wanted to actually respond to Brian. Excellent comments, but I thought I heard you say that the sort of the seasonal worker program was the first move away from a non-discriminatory migration policy. And I just want to go back to the backpackers, which is a highly discriminatory program and much bigger than the seasonal worker program. And then, as you mentioned, the Trans-Tasman arrangement. That's a big one.
You see.
I have a question for Brian as well. My question is with regards to the relation. How do you see the relationship between a binding regional trade agreement and the non-binding bilateral labor agreement, such as a seasonal workers program? It seems that the binding nature of a regional trade agreement would make it more advantageous in some ways, and the non-binding nature of a bilateral labor agreement may be advantageous as well. And so, therefore, maybe the two cannot go without the other. They need to be taken into context and, you know, use the benefits of both.
Well, I think one insight into that is if you look at the actual movement of persons under GATS Mode 4, it's pretty disappointing.
Yes.
And almost all of it relates to high-end skilled migration or semi-skilled migration, which is not going to be highly relevant in many countries in the Pacific. So even if you leave aside the difficulties of negotiation, which obviously are considerable, and that's why PACER Plus has been dragging on for such a long time, even once you have it, the extent to which it actually gives effect to labour mobility depends on the commitments that states make to it. And in relation to GATS, that's been the difficulty. So I agree with you in that the bilateral arrangements are much more flexible. They can be tailored to the needs of specific countries. The problem that I see with it is that if you look across the region, there are just lots of winners and losers in that situation, because how it all falls out is often just the product of sort of history and circumstance. So if Richard, you were saying that the seasonal workers system and the RSE system is now open to all Pacific countries, but in their first incarnations they weren't. There were just a few particular countries that were chosen. So I think part of the answer depends on whether you have a sort of a regional perspective on the issue and are keen to promote mobility across the region, or whether you're happy to contend with small piecemeal arrangements that might address some problems. Maybe that's better than nothing, but it seems less than is desirable, in my view.
We can go to the back first and then I'll come to the next one.
Yeah, I'm just intrigued by the, if we think about the future, 20, 30 years from now, could you imagine a world where there is movement going both ways between island nations, so Australians also, or New Zealanders also going to these islands and there being these kind of European Union style model, or is that too far out there? Regardless of the policy.
Yeah, the biggest challenge that will face the movement into the islands is the considerable restrictions that are placed on people who are not from those island countries or citizens of those island countries in terms of access to land and access to rights to reside. So in the case of New Zealand with the Cook Islands and Niue, all Cook Islands, Niueans can come into New Zealand if they wish. In one sense, you could say New Zealanders can go to the Cook Islands, but they can't live in the Cook Islands in the way the Cook Islanders can live. So they're not symmetrical. They're a bit like what the most of these arrangements are not symmetrical completely. And the, I mean, the Trans-Tasman travel arrangement with Australia and New Zealand is an example. Brian mentioned 4 million New Zealanders could come here, equally 23 million Australians tomorrow could go and live in New Zealand. There's nothing to stop them under the Trans-Tasman travel arrangement. The difference would be they'd all be eligible within a short time for unemployment benefit, and they'd also get the social welfare stuff, which you don't get now if you come here as a New Zealander. And they would also be eligible for citizenship. So you've got to think about those kind of movements. And this is one of the things that I think is really vexing Europe in terms of what does it really mean when you say you've got free movement? So you have to think underneath that, what do you get with that movement?
Carmen.
Yes, I wanted to make a few comments about Peter Blass, and I was very happy that both of you actually mentioned Peter Blass. I joined the OCTA, which is the office that coordinates the negotiating positions of the Farm Island countries a bit more than 3 years ago, and then stayed for a year and a bit, and I was in charge of that labor mobility chapter. And when I joined, the drafts of the labor mobility chapter were very different from what they are now. And the initial drafts are very broad. They did all sorts of, all aspects of labor mobility. They theoretically included mobility between Pacific Island countries as well as from New Zealanders and Australians moving to the islands. And they were part of a legally binding agreement. And then two things happened, I think. One was they became focused on improving just the seasonal worker schemes. And that is problematic in the sense that those schemes were already in existence, very independent of PACER Plus. But suddenly, and they all the PACER Plus negotiations focused only on those pre-existing schemes. And the schemes are really, it's the labor departments in the Four Island countries that are in charge of the seasonal work schemes, but it's the trade departments and the trade officials that negotiate PACER Plus. And that is problematic in quite a few countries where the two departments have different agendas and some rivalry issues as well. So that was one thing that happened. And the other thing that happened was that the legally binding nature of the chapter was lost because Australia argued that if they granted, if they made it a legally binding chapter, that would trigger their MFN, their most favored nation clauses in their bilateral trade agreements, for example, with China, and then the Chinese could also, demand that access. The Pacific Island countries argued that that would not be the case, but that argument wasn't accepted. So that's why now there will be a side arrangement. And I was interested that you said, you felt quite positive about it. I think, the big question will be what happens in September or whenever PACER Plus is supposed to decide, because especially in PNG and Fiji, there are doubts whether they will sign the agreement. And we have to wait to see what happens and whether all the smaller countries are actually happy with what is on the table or whether they are not. It's probably too early to
say. I think this is partly why New Zealand's decided that we'll go ahead with this meeting, because it's been waiting a long time for PACER Plus. Our Minister of Foreign Affairs has wanted it signed off for a couple of years now, and partly because he can see there's not going to be much else that's going to change, certainly not on the mobility side. And New Zealand, I think, is hoping that it can, and Australia's already anticipated this a little bit by lifting the cap on it's a concession already to PACER Plus. We'll take the cap off the seasonal worker program. And then the microstate visa is another example of how we're going to provide support. They're trying to make it clear to the Pacific that there is some teeth in this arrangement. It's not just talk. But Fiji coming back into the negotiations has certainly stiffened a lot of the demands. And that's, I think, part of the challenge Australia and New Zealand face as we move ahead, is making sure that Fiji is comfortable with a lot of the discussions and doesn't become a strong anti Australia-New Zealand agreement or arrangement falls.
Okay, Peter.
Yeah, it is possible to to discriminate administratively without discriminating legally. I remember in the early 1980s going to Manila, and Australia had 6 migration officers in Manila, and then I went to Jakarta and they had no migration officers in Jakarta. So you can apply, bring it to this kind of example. You can set up systems which make it easy for people to come administratively, to come from the Pacific. Well, it's not so easy from other places. So you can avoid the legal question.
Through a ministerial approach. And to a certain extent, I think New Zealand's played that game in the Middle East. If you want to come from pretty well anywhere in the Middle East, I think you've got to go to Africa to get a visa. I mean, that's not exactly a straight
Okay, I can't see a forest of hands, so I think this is a good time to finish. And indeed, to once again thank Richard for an inspiring talk, to thank Brian for being a discussant, to thank Peter for introducing me, but I'm sure we won that ticket match. We never lost that. And really also to thank Stephen and Richard particularly for putting this on. There's nothing like visitors like me from Sydney coming to experience Canberra winter. It's a real privilege and experience. I think it's been a really good day. It's been some really good sessions, and I thank you all for participating.
Very hard.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much. Okay.
've been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.